10. Atticus was feeble. He was nearly 50. When Jim and I asked him why he was so old, he said he got started late, which we felt reflected upon his abilities and manliness. He was much older than the parents of our school contemporaries, and there was nothing Jim or I could say about him when our classmates said, "My father..." Jim was football crazy. Atticus was never too tired to play keep away, but when Jim wanted to tackle him, Atticus would say, "I'm too old for that, son." Our father didn't do anything. He worked in an office, not in a drugstore. Atticus did not drive a dump truck for the county. He was not the sheriff. He did not farm, work in a garage, or do anything that could possibly arouse the admiration of anyone. Besides that, he wore glasses. He was nearly blind in his left eye and said left eyes were the tribal curse of the Finches. Whenever he wanted to see something well, he turned his head and looked from his right eye. He did not do the things our schoolmates' fathers did. He never went hunting. He did not play poker or fish or drink or smoke. He sat in the living room and read. With these attributes, however, he would not remain as inconspicuous as we wished him to. That year, the school buzzed with talk about him defending Tom Robinson, none of which was complimentary. After my bout with Cecil Jacobs, when I committed myself to a policy of cowardice, word got around that Scout Finch wouldn't fight anymore. Her daddy wouldn't let her. This was not entirely correct. I wouldn't fight publicly for Atticus, but the family was private ground. I would fight anyone from a third cousin upwards, tooth and nail. Francis Hancock, for example, knew that. When he gave us our air rifles, Atticus wouldn't teach us to shoot. Uncle Jack instructed us in the rudiments thereof. He said Atticus wasn't interested in guns. Atticus said to Jim one day, "I'd rather you shot at tin cans in the backyard, but I know you'll go after birds. Shoot all the blue jays you want, if you can hit 'em, but remember, it's a sin to kill a mockingbird." That was the only time I ever heard Atticus say it was a sin to do something, and I asked Miss Maudie about it. "Your father's right," she said. "Mockingbirds don't do one thing but make music for us to enjoy. They don't eat up people's gardens, don't nest in corn cribs. They don't do one thing but sing their hearts out for us. That's why it's a sin to kill a mockingbird." "Miss Maudie, this is an old neighborhood, ain't it?" "Been here longer than the town." "No'm, I mean the folks on our street are all old. Jim and me's the only children around here. Mrs. DeBose is close on to 100, and Miss Rachel's old, and so are you and Atticus." "I don't call 50 very old," said Miss Maudie tartly. "Not being wheeled around yet, am I? Neither's your father. But I must say Providence was kind enough to burn down that old mausoleum of mine. I'm too old to keep it up. Maybe you're right, Jean Louise. This is a settled neighborhood. You've never been around young folks much, have you?"
"Yes'm, at school."
"I mean young grown-ups. You're lucky, you know. You and Jim have the benefit of your father's age. If your father was 30, you'd find life quite different."
"I sure would. Atticus can't do anything."
"You'd be surprised," said Miss Maudie. "There's life in him yet."
"What can he do?"
"Well, he can make somebody's will so airtight can't anybody meddle with it."
"Shoot."
"Well, did you know he's the best checker player in this town? Why, down at the landing, when we were coming up, Atticus Finch could beat everybody on both sides of the river."
"Good Lord, Miss Maudie, Jim and me beat him all the time."
"It's about time you found out It's because he lets you. Did you know he can play a jew's harp? This modest accomplishment served to make me even more ashamed of him.
Well, she said.
Well, what, Miss Maudie?
Well, nothing.
Nothing. It seems with all that you'd be proud of him. Can't everybody play a jew's harp. Now keep out of the way of the carpenters. You better go home. I'll be in my azaleas and can't watch you. Plank might hit you.
I went to the backyard and found Jim plugging away at a tin can, which seemed stupid with all the blue jays around. I returned to the front yard and busied myself for 2 hours erecting a complicated breastworks at the side of the porch, consisting of a tire, an orange crate, the laundry hamper, the porch chairs, and a small U.S. flag Jim gave me from a popcorn box. When Atticus came home to dinner, he found me crouched down, aiming across the street.
"What are you shooting at?"
"Miss Maudie's rear end."
Atticus turned and saw my generous target bending over her bushes. He pushed his hat to the back of his head and crossed the street.
"Maudie," he called, "I thought I'd better warn you. You're in considerable peril."
Miss Maudie straightened up and looked toward me. She said,
"Atticus, you are a devil from hell."
When Atticus returned, he told me to break camp. "Don't you ever let me catch you pointing that gun at anybody again," he said. I wished my father was a devil from hell. I sounded out Calpurnia on the subject.
"Mr. Finch? Why, he can do lots of things."
"Like what?" I asked. Calpurnia scratched her head.
"Well, I don't rightly know," she said.
Jim underlined it when he asked Atticus if he was going out for the Methodist, and Atticus said he'd break his neck if he did. He was just too old for that sort of thing. The Methodists were trying to pay off their church mortgage and had challenged the Baptists to a game of touch football. Everybody in town's father was playing, it seemed, except Atticus. Jim said he didn't even want to go, but he was unable to resist football in any form, and he stood gloomily on the sidelines with Atticus and me, watching Cecil Jacobs' father make touchdowns for the Baptists. One Saturday, Jim and I decided to go exploring with our air rifles to see if we could find a rabbit or a squirrel. We had gone about 500 yards beyond the Radley place when I noticed Jim squinting at something down the street. He had turned his head to one side and was looking out of the corners of his eyes.
"What you looking at?"
"That old dog down yonder," he said.
"That's old Tim Johnson, ain't it?"
"Yeah." Tim Johnson was the property of Mr. Harry Johnson, who drove the Mobile bus and lived on the southern edge of town. Tim was a liver-colored bird dog, the pet of Makem.
"What's he doing?"
"I don't know, Scout. We'd better go home."
"Oh, Jim, it's February."
"I don't care. I'm going to tell Cal." We raced home and ran to the kitchen.
"Cal," said Jim, "can you come down the sidewalk a minute?"
"What for, Jim? I can't come down the sidewalk every time you want me. There's something wrong with an old dog down yonder." Calpurnia sighed. "I can't wrap up any dog's foot now. There's some gauze in the bathroom. Go get it and do it yourself." Jim shook his head. "He's sick, Cal. Something's wrong with him."
"What's he doing, trying to catch his tail?"
"No, he's doing like this." Jim gulped like a goldfish, hunched his shoulders, and twitched his torso. "He's going like that, only not like he means to."
"Are you telling me a story, Jim Finch?" Calpurnia's voice hardened.
"No, Cal, I swear I'm not."
"Was he running?"
"No, he's just moseying along so slow you can't hardly tell it. He's coming this way." Calpurnia rinsed her hands and followed Jim into the yard.
"I don't see any dog," she said. She followed us beyond the Radley place and looked where Jim pointed. Tim Johnson was not much more than a speck in the distance, but he was closer to us. He walked erratically, as if his right legs were shorter than his left legs. He reminded me of a car stuck in a sandbed. "He's gone lopsided," said Jim. Calpurnia stared, then grabbed us by the shoulders and ran us home. She shut the wood door behind us, went to the telephone, and shouted, "Gimme Mr. Finch's office!" "Mr. Finch," she shouted, "this is Cal. I swear to God there's a mad dog down the street apiece. He's coming this way. Yes, sir, he's... Mr. Finch, I declare he is old Tim Johnson. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes." She hung up and shook her head when we tried to ask her what Atticus had said. She rattled the telephone hook and said, "Miss Eula May? Now, ma'am, I'm through talking to Mr. Finch. Please don't connect me no more. Listen, Miss Eula May, can you call Miss Rachel and Miss Stephanie Crawford and whoever's got a phone on this street and tell them a mad dog's coming? Please, ma'am." Calpurnia listened. "I know it's February, Miss Eula May, but I know a mad dog when I see one. Please, ma'am, hurry." Calpurnia asked Jim, "Radley's got a phone?" Jim looked in the book and said, "No. They won't come out anyway, Cal." "I don't care. I'm going to tell them." She ran to the front porch, Jim and I at her heels. "You stay in that house," she yelled. Calpurnia's message had been received by the neighborhood. Every wood door within our range of vision was closed tight. We saw no trace of Tim Johnson. We watched Calpurnia running toward the Radley place, holding her skirt and apron above her knees. She went up to the front steps and banged on the door. She got no answer, and she shouted, "Mr. Nathan! Mr. Arthur! Mad dog's coming! Mad dog's coming!" "She's supposed to go around in back," I said. Jim shook his head. "Don't make any difference now," he said. Calpurnia pounded on the door in vain. No one acknowledged her warning. No one seemed to have heard it. As Calpurnia sprinted to the back porch, a black Ford swung into the driveway. Atticus and Mr. Heck Tate got out. Mr. Heck Tate was the sheriff of Macomb County. He was as tall as Atticus, but thinner. He was long-nosed, wore boots with shiny metal eye holes, boot pants, and a lumber jacket. His belt had a row of bullets sticking in it. He carried a heavy rifle. When he and Atticus reached the porch, Jim opened the door.
"Stay inside, son," said Atticus. "Where is he, Cal?"
"He ought to be here by now," said Calpurnia, pointing down the street.
"Not running, is he?" asked Mr. Tate.
"No, sir. He's in the twitching stage, Mr. Heck."
"Should we go after him, Heck?" asked Atticus. "We better wait, Mr. Finch. They usually go in a straight line, but you never can tell. He might follow the curve. Hope he does, or he'll go straight in the Radley backyard. Let's wait a minute." "Don't think he'll get in the Radley yard," said Atticus. "Fence'll stop him. He'll probably follow the road."
I thought mad dogs foamed at the mouth, galloped, leaped, and lunged at throats, and I thought they did it in August. Had Tim Johnson behaved thus, I would have been less frightened. Nothing is more deadly than a deserted, waiting street. The trees were still. The mockingbirds were silent. The carpenters at Miss Maudie's house had vanished. I heard Mr. Tate sniff, then blow his nose. I saw him shift his gun to the crook of his arm. I saw Miss Stephanie Crawford's face framed in the glass window of her front door. Miss Maudie appeared and stood beside her. Atticus put his foot on the rung of a chair and rubbed his hand slowly down the side of his thigh.
"There he is," he said softly. Tim Johnson came into sight, walking dazedly in the inner rim of the curve parallel to the Radley house. "Look at him," whispered Jim. "Mr. Heck said they walked in a straight line. He can't even stay in the road."
"He looks more sick than anything," I said. "Let anything get in front of him and he'll come straight at it."
Mr. Tate put his hand to his forehead and leaned forward.
"He's got it all right, Mr. Finch."
Tim Johnson was advancing at a snail's pace, but he was not playing or sniffing at foliage. He seemed dedicated to one course and motivated by an invisible force that was inching him toward us. We could see him shiver like a horse shedding flies. His jaw opened and shut. He was a list, but he was being pulled gradually toward us. "He's looking for a place to die," said Jim. Mr. Tate turned around. "He's far from dead, Jim. He hasn't got started yet." Tim Johnson reached the side street that ran in front of the Radley place, and what remained of his poor mind made him pause and seem to consider which road he would take. He made a few hesitant steps and stopped in front of the Radley gate. Then he tried to turn around, but was having difficulty. Atticus said, "He's within range, Heck. You better get him now before he goes down the side street. Lord knows who's around the corner. Go inside, Cal." Calpurnia opened the screen door, latched it behind her, then unlatched it and held onto the hook. She tried to block Jim and me with her body, but we looked out from beneath her arms. "Take him, Mr. Finch." Mr. Tate handed the rifle to Atticus. "Jim and I nearly fainted." "Don't waste time, Heck," said Atticus. "Go on." "Mr. Finch, this is a one-shot job." Atticus shook his head vehemently. "Don't just stand there, Heck. He won't wait all day for you."
"For God's sake, Mr. Finch, look where he is. Miss, and you'll go straight into the Radley house. I can't shoot that well, and you know it."
"I haven't shot a gun in 30 years. Mr. Tate almost threw the rifle at Atticus. "I'd feel mighty comfortable if you did now," he said. In a fog, Jim and I watched our father take the gun and walk out into the middle of the street. He walked quickly, but I thought he moved like an underwater swimmer. Time had slowed to a nauseating crawl. When Atticus raised his glasses, Calpurnia murmured, "Sweet Jesus, help him," and put her hands to her cheeks. Atticus pushed his glasses to his forehead. They slipped down, and he dropped them in the street. In the silence, I heard them crack. Atticus rubbed his eyes and chin. We saw him blink hard. In front of the Radley gate, Tim Johnson had made up what was left of his mind. He had finally turned himself around to pursue his original course up our street. He made 2 steps forward, then stopped and raised his head. We saw his body go rigid. With movements so swift they seemed simultaneous, Atticus's hand yanked a ball-tipped lever as he brought the gun to his shoulder. The rifle cracked. Tim Johnson leaped, flopped over, and crumpled on the sidewalk in a brown and white heap. He didn't know what hit him. One Saturday, Jim and I decided to go exploring with our air rifles to see if we could find a rabbit or a squirrel. We had gone about 500 yards beyond the Radley place when I noticed Jim squinting at something down the street. He had turned his head to one side and was looking out of the corners of his eyes. "What you looking at?" "That old dog down yonder," he said. "That's old Tim Johnson, ain't it?"
"Yeah."
Tim Johnson was the property of Mr. Harry Johnson, who drove the Mobile bus and lived on the southern edge of town. Tim was a liver-colored bird dog, the pet of Makem. What's he doing?
I don't know, Scout. We better go home.
Oh, Jim, it's February.
I don't care. I'm going to tell Cal.
We raced home and ran to the kitchen.
Cal, said Jim, can you come down the sidewalk a minute?
What for, Jim? I can't come down the sidewalk every time you want me. There's something wrong with an old dog down yonder.
Calpurnia sighed. I can't wrap up any dog's foot now. There's some gauze in the bathroom. Go get it and do it yourself.
Jim shook his head. He's sick, Cal. Something's wrong with him.
What's he doing, trying to catch his tail?
No, he's doing like this.
Jim gulped like a goldfish, hunched his shoulders, and twitched his torso.
He's going like that, only not like he means to.
Are you telling me a story, Jim Finch? Calpurnia's voice hardened.
No, Cal, I swear I'm not.
Was he running?
No, he's just moseying along so slow you can't hardly tell it. He's coming this way.
Calpurnia rinsed her hands and followed Jim into the yard.
I don't see any dog, she said.
She followed us beyond the Radley place and looked where Jim pointed. Tim Johnson was not much more than a speck in the distance, but he was closer to us. He walked erratically, as if his right legs were shorter than his left legs. He reminded me of a car stuck in a sandbed.
He's gone lopsided, said Jim.
Calpurnia stared, then grabbed us by the shoulders and ran us home. She shut the wood door behind us, went to the telephone, and shouted, "Give me Mr. Finch's office."
"Mr. Finch," she shouted, "this is Cal. I swear to God there's a mad dog down the street a piece. He's coming this way. Yes, sir, he's... Mr. Finch, I declare he is... Old Tim Johnson. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes.
She hung up and shook her head when we tried to ask her what Atticus had said. She rattled the telephone hook and said, "Miss Eula May?
Now, ma'am, I'm through talking to Mr. Finch. Please don't connect me no more. Listen, Miss Eula May, can you call Miss Rachel and Miss Stephanie Crawford and whoever's got a phone on this street and tell him a mad dog's coming? Please, ma'am."
Calpurnia listened.
"I know it's February, Miss Eula May, but I know a mad dog when I see one. Please, ma'am, hurry."
Calpurnia asked Jim, "Radley's got a phone?" Jim looked in the book and said, "No. They won't come out anyway, Cal."
"I don't care. I'm going to tell them." She ran to the front porch, Jim and I at her heels. "You stay in that house," she yelled.
Calpurnia's message had been received by the neighborhood. Every wood door within our range of vision was closed tight. We saw no trace of Tim Johnson. We watched Calpurnia running toward the Radley place, holding her skirt and apron above her knees. She went up to the front steps and banged on the door. She got no answer, and she shouted,
"Mr. Nathan! Mr. Arthur! Mad dog's coming! Mad dog's coming!"
"She's supposed to go around in back," I said.
Jim shook his head. "Don't make any difference now," he said.
Calpurnia pounded on the door in vain. No one acknowledged her warning. No one seemed to have heard it. As Calpurnia sprinted to the back porch, a black Ford swung into the driveway. Atticus and Mr. Heck Tate got out. Mr. Heck Tate was the sheriff of Macomb County. He was as tall as Atticus, but thinner. He was long-nosed, wore boots with shiny metal eye-holes, boot pants, and a lumber jacket. His belt had a row of bullets sticking in it. He carried a heavy rifle. When he and Atticus reached the porch, Jim opened the door.
"Stay inside, son," said Atticus. "Where is he, Cal?"
"He ought to be here by now.
said Calpurnia, pointing down the street.
"Not running, is he?" asked Mr. Tate.
"No, sir. He's in the twitching stage, Mr. Heck."
"Should we go after him, Heck?" asked Atticus.
"We better wait, Mr. Finch. They usually go in a straight line, but you never can tell. He might follow the curve. Hope he does, or he'll go straight in the Radley backyard. Let's wait a minute."
"Don't think he'll get in the Radley yard," said Atticus. "Fence'll stop him. He'll probably follow the road."
I thought mad dogs foamed at the mouth, galloped, leaped, and lunged at throats, and I thought they did it in August. Had Tim Johnson behaved thus, I would have been less frightened. Nothing is more deadly than a deserted, waiting street. The trees were still, the mockingbirds were silent, the carpenters at Miss Maudie's house had vanished. I heard Mr. Tate sniff, then blow his nose. I saw him shift his gun to the crook of his arm. I saw Miss Stephanie Crawford's face framed in the glass window of her front door. Miss Maudie appeared and stood beside her. Atticus put his foot on the rung of a chair and rubbed his hand slowly down the side of his thigh. "There he is," he said softly. Tim Johnson came into sight, walking dazedly in the inner rim of the curve parallel to the Radley house.
"Look at him," whispered Jim. "Mr. Heck said they walked in a straight line. He can't even stay in the road."
"He looks more sick than anything," I said. "Let anything get in front of him and he'll come straight at it."
Mr. Tate put his hand to his forehead and leaned forward.
"He's got it all right, Mr. Finch."
Tim Johnson was advancing at a snail's pace, but he was not playing or sniffing at foliage. He seemed dedicated to one course and motivated by an invisible force that was inching him toward us. We could see him shiver like a horse shedding flies. His jaw opened and shut. He was a list, but he was being pulled gradually toward us.
"He's looking for a place to die," said Jim.
Mr. Tate turned around. "He's far from dead, Jim. He hasn't got started yet." Tim Johnson reached the side street that ran in front of the Radley place, and what remained of his poor mind made him pause and seem to consider which road he would take. He made a few hesitant steps and stopped in front of the Radley gate. Then he tried to turn around, but was having difficulty. Mr. Tate jumped off the porch and ran to the Radley place. He stopped in front of the dog, squatted, turned around, and tapped his finger on his forehead above his left eye.
"You were a little to the right, Mr. Finch," he called.
"Always was," answered Atticus. "If I had my druthers, I'd take a shotgun."
He stooped and picked up his glasses, ground the broken lenses to powder under his heel, and went to Mr. Tate and stood looking down at Tim Johnson. Doors opened one by one, and the neighborhood slowly came alive. Miss Maudie walked down the steps with Miss Stephanie Crawford. Jim was paralyzed. I pinched him to get him moving, but when Atticus saw us coming, he called,
"Stay where you are."
When Mr. Tate and Atticus returned to the yard, Mr. Tate was smiling.
"I'll have Zebo collect him," he said. "You haven't forgotten much, Mr. Finch. They say it never leaves you."
Atticus was silent.
"Atticus?" said Jim.
"Yes."
"Nothing." "I saw that one shot, Finch."
Atticus wheeled and faced Miss Maudie. They looked at one another without saying anything, and Atticus got into the sheriff's car.
"Come here," he said to Jim. "Don't you go near that dog, you understand? Don't go near him. He's just as dangerous dead as alive."
"Yes, sir," said Jim.
"Atticus?" What, son?
Nothing.
What's the matter with you, boy? Can't you talk? Said Mr. Tate, grinning at Jim. Didn't you know your daddy's...
Hush, heck, said Atticus. Let's go back to town.
When they drove away, Jim and I went to Miss Stephanie's front steps. We sat waiting for Zeebo to arrive in the garbage truck. Jim sat in numb confusion, and Miss Stephanie said, "Mm-mm-mm, who'd have thought of a mad dog in February? Maybe he wasn't mad. Maybe he was just crazy. I'd hate to see Harry Johnson's face when he gets in from the Mobile run and finds Atticus Finch has shot his dog. But he was just full of fleas from somewhere." Miss Maudie said Miss Stephanie'd be singing a different tune if Tim Johnson was still coming up the street. That they'd find out soon enough. They'd send his head to Montgomery. Jim became vaguely articulate.
"D'you see him, Scout? D'you see him just standing there? And all of a sudden he just relaxed all over, and it looked like that gun was a part of him. And he did it so quick-like. I have to aim for 10 minutes before I can hit something."
Miss Maudie grinned wickedly. "Well, now, Miss Jean Louise," she said, "still think your father can't do anything? Still ashamed of him?"
"No'm," I said meekly.
"Forgot to tell you the other day that besides playing the jew's harp, Atticus Finch was the deadest shot in Macomb County in his time."
"Dead shot," echoed Jim.
"That what I said, Jim Finch. Guess you'll change your tune now." "The very idea. Didn't you know his nickname was Old One-Shot when he was a boy? Why, down at the landing, when he was coming up, if he shot 15 times and hit 14 does, he'd complain about wasted ammunition."
"He never said anything about that," Jim muttered.
"Never said anything about it, did he?"
"No, ma'am."
"Wonder why he never goes hunting now," I said.
"Maybe I can tell you," said Miss Maudie. "If your father's anything, he's civilized in his heart. Marksmanship's a gift of God, a talent. Oh, you have to practice to make it perfect, but shooting's different from playing the piano or the like. I think maybe he put his gun down when he realized that God had given him an unfair advantage over most living things. I guess he decided he wouldn't shoot till he had to. And he had to today."
"Looks like he'd be proud of it," I said.
"People in their right minds never take pride in their talents," said Miss Maudie.
We saw Zeebo drive up. He took a pitchfork from the back of the garbage truck and gingerly lifted Tim Johnson. He pitched the dog onto the truck, then poured something from a gallon jug on and around the spot where Tim fell. "Don't y'all come over here for a while," he called. When we went home, I told Jim we'd really have something to talk about at school on Monday. Jim turned on me.
"Don't say anything about it, Scout," he said.
"What? I certainly am. Ain't everybody's daddy the deadest shot in Macomb County?" Jim said, "I reckon if he wanted us to know it, he'd have told us. If he was proud of it, he'd have told us."
"Maybe it just slipped his mind," I said.
"Nah, Scout, it's something you wouldn't understand. Atticus is real old, but I wouldn't care if he couldn't do anything. I wouldn't care if he couldn't do a blessed thing." Jim picked up a rock and threw it jubilantly at the car house. Running after it, he called back, "Atticus is a gentleman, just like me."
11. When we were small, Jim and I confined our activities to the southern neighborhood. But when I was well into the second grade at school, and tormenting Boo Radley became passé, the business section of Macomb drew us frequently up the street past the real property of Mrs. Henry Lafayette DeBose. It was impossible to go to town without passing her house, unless we wished to walk a mile out of the way.
Previous minor encounters with her left me with no desire for more, but Jim said I had to grow up sometime. Mrs. DeBose lived alone, except for a Negro girl in constant attendance. Two doors up the street from us, and a house with steep front steps and a dog trot hall. She was very old. She spent most of each day in bed, and the rest of it in a wheelchair. It was rumored that she kept a CSA pistol concealed among her numerous shawls and wraps. Jim and I hated her. If she was on the porch when we passed, we would be raked by her wrathful gaze, subjected to ruthless interrogation regarding our behavior, and given a melancholy prediction on what we would amount to when we grew up, which was always nothing. We had long ago given up the idea of walking past her house on the opposite side of the street. That only made her raise her voice and let the whole neighborhood in on it. We could do nothing to please her. If I said as sunnily as I could, "Hey, Mrs. DeBose," I would receive for an answer, "Don't you say hey to me, you ugly girl. You say good afternoon, Mrs. DeBose." She was vicious. Once she heard Jim refer to our father as Atticus, and her reaction was apoplectic. Besides being the sassiest, most disrespectful mutts who ever passed her way, we were told that it was quite a pity our father had not remarried after our mother's death. A lovelier lady than our mother never lived, she said, and it was heartbreaking the way Atticus Finch let her children run wild. I did not remember our mother, but Jim did. He would tell me about her sometimes, and he went livid when Mrs. DeBose shot us this message. Jim, having survived Boo Radley, a mad dog, and other terrors, and concluded that it was cowardly to stop at Miss Rachel's front steps and wait, and had decreed that we must run as far as the post office corner each evening to meet Atticus coming from work. Countless evenings Atticus would find Jim furious at something Mrs. DeBose had said when we went by. "Easy does it, son," Atticus would say. "She's an old lady, and she's ill. You just hold your head high and be a gentleman. Whatever she says to you, it's your job not to let her make you mad." Jim would say she must not be very sick, she hollered so. When the three of us came to her house, Atticus would sweep off his hat, wave gallantly to her, and say, "Good evening, Mrs. DeBose. You look like a picture this evening." I never heard Atticus say like a picture of what. He would tell her the courthouse news and would say he hoped with all his heart she'd have a good day tomorrow. He would return his hat to his head, swing me to his shoulders in her very presence, and we would go home in the twilight. It was times like these when I thought my father, who hated guns and had never been to any wars, was the bravest man who ever lived. The day after Jim's 12th birthday, his money was burning up his pockets, so we headed for town in the early afternoon. Jim thought he had enough to buy a miniature steam engine for himself and a twirling baton for me. I had long had my eye on that baton. It was at V.J. Elmore's. It was bedecked with sequins and tinsel. It cost 17 cents. It was then my burning ambition to grow up and twirl with the Macomb County High School Band. Having developed my talent to where I could throw up a stick and almost catch it coming down, I had caused Calpurnia to deny me entrance to the house every time she saw me with a stick in my hand. I felt that I could overcome this defect with a real baton, and I thought it generous of Jim to buy one for me. Mrs. DeBose was stationed on her porch when we went by. "Where are you two going at this time of day?" she shouted. "Playing hooky, I suppose. I'll just call up the principal and tell him."
She put her hands on the wheels of her chair and executed a perfect right face.
It's Saturday, Mrs. DeBose, said Jim.
Makes no difference if it's Saturday, she said obscurely. I wonder if your father knows where you are.
Mrs. DeBose, we've been going to town by ourselves since we were this high.
Jim placed his hand, palm down, about 2 feet above the sidewalk.
Don't you lie to me, she yelled. Jeremy Finch, Maudie Atkinson told me you broke down her scuppernong arbor this morning. She's going to tell your father, and then you'll wish you never saw the light of day. If you aren't sent to the reform school before next week, my name's not DeBose.
Jim, who hadn't been near Miss Maudie's scuppernong arbor since last summer, and who knew Miss Maudie wouldn't tell Atticus if he had, issued a general denial.
"Don't you contradict me," Mrs. DeBose bawled. "And you," she pointed an arthritic finger at me, "what are you doing in those overalls? You should be in a dress and camisole, young lady. You'll grow up waiting on tables if somebody doesn't change your ways. A Finch waiting on tables at the O.K. Cafe. Ha!"
I was terrified. The O.K. Cafe was a dim organization on the north side of the square. I grabbed Jim's hand, but he shook me loose. "Come on, Scout," he whispered. "Don't pay any attention to her. Just hold your head high and be a gentleman."
But Mrs. DeBose held us. Not only a Finch waiting on tables, but one in the courthouse lawing for niggers.
Jim stiffened. Mrs. DeBose's shot had gone home, and she knew it.
"Yes, indeed. What has this world come to when a Finch goes against his raising? I'll tell you."
She put her hand to her mouth. When she drew it away, it trailed a long silver thread of saliva.
"Your father's no better than the niggers and trash he works for."
Jim was scarlet. I pulled at his sleeve, and we were followed up the sidewalk by a philippic on our family's moral degeneration. The major premise of which was that half the Finches were in the asylum anyway, but if our mother were living, we would not have come to such a state. I wasn't sure what Jim resented most, but I took umbrage at Mrs. DeBose's assessment of the family's mental hygiene. I had become almost accustomed to hearing insults aimed at Atticus, but this was the first one coming from an adult. Except for her remarks about Atticus, Mrs. DeBose's attack was only routine. There was a hint of summer in the air. In the shadows it was cool, but the sun was warm, which meant good times coming. No school and dill. Jim bought his steam engine, and we went by Elmore's for my baton. Jim took no pleasure in his acquisition. He jammed it in his pocket and walked silently beside me toward home. On the way home, I nearly hit Mr. Link Dees, who said, "Look out now, Scout," when I missed a toss. And when we approached Mrs. DeBose's house, my baton was grimy from having picked it up out of the dirt so many times. She was not on the porch. In later years, I sometimes wondered exactly what made Jim do it. What made him break the bonds of, "You just be a gentleman, son," and the phase of self-conscious rectitude he had recently entered. Jim had probably stood as much guff about Atticus lawing for niggers as had I, and I took it for granted that he kept his temper. He had a naturally tranquil disposition and a slow fuse. At the time, however, I thought the only explanation for what he did was that for a few minutes he simply went mad. What Jim did was something I'd do, as a matter of course, had I not been under Atticus's interdict, which I assumed included not fighting horrible old ladies. We had just come to her gate when Jim snatched my baton and ran flailing wildly up the steps into Mrs. DeBose's front yard, forgetting everything Atticus had said, forgetting that she packed a pistol under her shawls, forgetting that if Mrs. DeBose missed, her girl Jessie probably wouldn't.
He did not begin to calm down until he had cut the tops off every camellia bush Mrs. DeBose owned, until the ground was littered with green buds and leaves. He bent my baton against his knee, snapped it in two, and threw it down. By that time, I was shrieking. Jim yanked my hair, said he didn't care, he'd do it again if he got a chance, and if I didn't shut up, he'd pull every hair out of my head. I didn't shut up, and he kicked me. I lost my balance and fell on my face. Jim picked me up roughly, but looked like he was sorry. There was nothing to say. We did not choose to meet Atticus coming home that evening. We skulked around the kitchen until Calpurnia threw us out. By some voodoo system, Calpurnia seemed to know all about it. She was a less than satisfactory source of palliation, but she did give Jim a hot biscuit and butter, which he tore in half and shared with me. It tasted like cotton. We went to the living room. I picked up a football magazine, found a picture of Dixie Howell, showed it to Jim, and said, "This looks like you." That was the nicest thing I could think to say to him, but it was no help. He sat by the windows, hunched down in a rocking chair, scowling, waiting. Daylight faded. 2 geological ages later, we heard the soles of Atticus's shoes scrape the front steps. The screen door slammed. There was a pause. Atticus was at the hat rack in the hall, and we heard him call, "Jim?" His voice was like the winter wind. Atticus switched on the ceiling light in the living room and found us there, frozen still. He carried my baton in one hand. Its filthy yellow tassel trailed on the rug. He held out his other hand. It contained fat camellia buds. "Jim," he said, "are you responsible for this?" "Yes, sir." "Why'd you do it?" Jim said softly. "She said you lawed for niggers and trash." "You did this because she said that?" Jim's lips moved, but his "yes, sir" was inaudible. "Son, I have no doubt that you've been annoyed by your contemporaries about me lawing for niggers, as you say. But to do something like this to a sick old lady is inexcusable. I strongly advise you to go down and have a talk with Mrs. DeBose," said Atticus. "Come straight home afterward." Jim did not move. "Go on," I said. I followed Jim out of the living room. "Come back here," Atticus said to me. I came back. Atticus picked up the mobile press and sat down in the rocking chair Jim had vacated. For the life of me, I did not understand how he could sit there in cold blood and read a newspaper when his only son stood an excellent chance of being murdered with a Confederate Army relic. Of course, Jim antagonized me sometimes until I could kill him. But when it came down to it, he was all I had. Atticus did not seem to realize this, or if he did, he didn't care. I hated him for that, but when you are in trouble, you become easily tired. Soon I was hiding in his lap, and his arms were around me. "You're mighty big to be rocked," he said. "You don't care what happens to him," I said. "You just send him on to get shot at when all he was doing was standing up for you." Atticus pushed my head under his chin. "It's not time to worry yet," he said. "I never thought Jim would be the one to lose his head over this. Thought I'd have more trouble with you." I said I didn't see why we had to keep our heads anyway, that nobody I knew at school had to keep his head about anything. "Scout," said Atticus, "when summer comes, you'll have to keep your head about far worse things. It's not fair for you and Jim, I know that, but sometimes we have to make the best of things,
and the way we conduct ourselves when the chips are down, well, all I can say is, when you and Jim are grown, maybe you'll look back on this with some compassion and some feeling that I didn't let you down. This case, Tom Robinson's case, is something that goes to the essence of a man's conscience. Scout, I couldn't go to church and worship God if I didn't try to help that man.
Atticus, you must be wrong.
How's that?
Well, most folks seem to think they're right and you're wrong.
They're certainly entitled to think that, and they're entitled to full respect for their opinions, said Atticus. But before I can live with other folks, I've got to live with myself. The one thing that doesn't abide by majority rule is a person's conscience. When Jim returned, he found me still in Atticus's lap. "Well, son," said Atticus. He set me on my feet, and I made a secret reconnaissance of Jim. He seemed to be all in one piece, but he had a queer look on his face. Perhaps she had given him a dose of calomel. I cleaned it up for her and said I was sorry, but I ain't, and that I'd work on 'em every Saturday and try to make 'em grow back out. There was no point in saying you were sorry if you aren't, said Atticus. Jim, she's old and ill. You can't hold her responsible for what she says and does. Of course, I'd rather she'd have said it to me than to either of you, but we can't always have our druthers. Jim seemed fascinated by a rose in the carpet. Atticus, he said, she wants me to read to her.
Read to her?
Yes, sir. She wants me to come every afternoon after school and Saturdays and read to her out loud for 2 hours. Atticus, do I have to?
Certainly.
But she wants me to do it for a month.
Then you'll do it for a month.
Jim planted his big toe delicately in the center of the rose and pressed it in. Finally he said, Atticus, it's all right on the sidewalk, but inside it's all dark and creepy. There's shadows and things on the ceiling. Atticus smiled grimly.
That should appeal to your imagination. Just pretend you're inside the Radley house.
The following Monday afternoon, Jim and I climbed the steep front steps to Mrs. DeBose's house and padded down the open hallway. Jim, armed with Ivanhoe and full of superior knowledge, knocked at the second door on the left. Mrs. DeBose, he called. Jesse opened the wood door and unlatched the screen door.
Is that you, Jim Finch? She said. You got your sister with you? I don't know.
Let 'em both in, Jesse, said Mrs. DeBose.
Jesse admitted us and went off to the kitchen.
An oppressive odor met us when we crossed the threshold, an odor I had met many times in rain-rotted gray houses where there are coal oil lamps, water dippers, and unbleached domestic sheets. It always made me afraid, expectant, watchful. In the corner of the room was a brass bed, and in the bed was Mrs. DeBose. I wondered if Jim's activities had put her there, and for a moment I felt sorry for her. She was lying under a pile of quilts and looked almost friendly. There was a marble-topped washstand by her bed. On it were a glass with a teaspoon in it, a red ear syringe, a box of absorbent cotton, and a steel alarm clock standing on 3 tiny legs.
"So you brought that dirty little sister of yours, did you?" was her greeting.
Jim said quietly,
"My sister ain't dirty, and I ain't scared of you,"
although I noticed his knees shaking.
I was expecting a tirade, but all she said was, "You may commence reading, Jeremy." Jim sat down in a cane-bottomed chair and opened Ivanhoe.
I pulled up another one and sat beside him. "Come closer," said Mrs. DeBose. "Come to the side of the bed." We moved our chairs forward. This was the nearest I had ever been to her, and the thing I wanted most to do was move my chair back again. She was horrible. Her face was the color of a dirty pillowcase, and the corners of her mouth glistened with wet, which inched like a glacier down the deep grooves enclosing her chin. Old age liver spots dotted her cheeks, and her pale eyes had black pinpoint pupils. Her hands were knobby, and the cuticles were grown up over her fingernails. Her bottom plate was not in, and her upper lip protruded. From time to time she would draw her nether lip to her upper plate and carry her chin with it. This made the wet move faster. I didn't look any more than I had to. Jim reopened Ivanhoe and began reading. I tried to keep up with him, but he read too fast. When Jim came to a word he didn't know, he skipped it, but Mrs. DeBose would catch him and make him spell it out. Jim read for perhaps 20 minutes, during which time I looked at the soot-stained mantelpiece, out the window, anywhere to keep from looking at her. As he read along, I noticed that Mrs. DeBose's corrections grew fewer and farther between, that Jim had even left one sentence dangling in midair. She was not listening. I looked toward the bed. Something had happened to her. She lay on her back, with the quilts up to her chin. Only her head and shoulders were visible. Her head moved slowly from side to side. From time to time she would open her mouth wide, and I could see her tongue undulate faintly. Cords of saliva would collect on her lips. She would draw them in, then open her mouth again. Her mouth seemed to have a private existence of its own. It worked separate and apart from the rest of her, out and in, like a clam hole at low tide. Occasionally it would say, "Pt," like some vicious substance coming to a boil. I pulled Jim's sleeve. He looked at me, then at the bed. Her head made its regular sweep toward us, and Jim said, "Mrs. DeBose, are you all right?" She did not hear him. The alarm clock went off and scared us stiff. A minute later, nerves still tingling, Jim and I were on the sidewalk headed for home. We did not run away. Jesse sent us. Before the clock wound down, she was in the room pushing Jim and me out of it. "Shoo," she said. "You all go home." Jim hesitated at the door. "It's time for her medicine," Jesse said. As the door swung shut behind us, I saw Jesse walking quickly toward Mrs. DeBose's bed. It was only 3:45 when we got home, so Jim and I drop-kicked in the backyard until it was time to meet Atticus. Atticus had 2 yellow pencils for me and a football magazine for Jim, which I suppose was a silent reward for our first day's session with Mrs. DeBose. Jim told him what happened. "Did she frighten you?" asked Atticus. "No, sir," said Jim. "But she's so nasty. She has fits or something. She spits a lot." "She can't help that. When people are sick, they don't look nice sometimes." "She scared me," I said. Atticus looked at me over his glasses. "You don't have to go with Jim, you know." The next afternoon at Mrs. DeBose's was the same as the first, and so was the next, until gradually a pattern emerged. Everything would begin normally. That is, Mrs. DeBose would hound Jim for a while on her favorite subjects, her camellias and our father's nigger-loving propensities. She would grow increasingly silent, then go away from us. The alarm clock would ring, Jesse would shoo us out, and the rest of the day was ours. "Atticus," I said one evening, "what exactly is a nigger lover?" Atticus's face was grave.
Has somebody been calling you that?
No, sir. Mrs. DeBowes calls you that. She warms up every afternoon calling you that. Francis called me that last Christmas. That's where I first heard it.
Is that the reason you jumped on him?
Asked Atticus.
Yes, sir.
Then why are you asking me what it means?
I tried to explain to Atticus that it wasn't so much what Francis said that had infuriated me as the way he had said it. It was like he'd said snot nose or something.
Scout, said Atticus, nigger lover is just one of those terms that don't mean anything. Like snot nose. It's hard to explain. Ignorant, trashy people use it when they think somebody's favoring Negroes over and above themselves. It's slipped into usage with some people like ourselves when they want a common, ugly term to label somebody.
You aren't really a nigger lover, then, are you?
I certainly am. I do my best to love everybody. I'm hard put sometimes. Baby, it's never an insult to be called what somebody thinks is a bad name. It just shows you how poor that person is. It doesn't hurt you. So don't let Mrs. DeBowes get you down. She has enough troubles of her own. One afternoon, a month later, Jim was plowing his way through Sir Walter Scout, as Jim called him, and Mrs. DeBowes was correcting him at every turn, when there was a knock on the door.
"Come in!"
she screamed. Atticus came in. He went to the bed and took Mrs. DeBowes's hand. "I was coming from the office and didn't see the children," he said. "I thought they might still be here." Mrs. DeBowes smiled at him. For the life of me, I could not figure out how she could bring herself to speak to him when she seemed to hate him so.
"Do you know what time it is, Atticus?" she said. "Exactly 5:14. The alarm clock's set for 5:30. I want you to know that."
It suddenly came to me that each day we had been staying a little longer at Mrs. DeBowes's, that the alarm clock went off a few minutes later every day, and that she was well into one of her fits by the time it sounded. Today she had antagonized Jim for nearly 2 hours with no intention of having a fit, and I felt hopelessly trapped. The alarm clock was the signal for our release. If one day it did not ring, what would we do? "I have a feeling that Jim's reading days are numbered," said Atticus.
"Only a week longer, I think," she said, "just to make sure."
Jim rose, but Atticus put out his hand and Jim was silent. On the way home, Jim said he had to do it just for a month, and the month was up, and it wasn't fair.
"Just one more week, son," said Atticus.
"No," said Jim.
"Yes," said Atticus.
The following week found us back at Mrs. DeBowes's. The alarm clock had ceased sounding, but Mrs. DeBowes would release us with, "That'll do." So late in the afternoon, Atticus would be home reading the paper when we returned. Although her fits had passed off, she was in every other way her old self. When Sir Walter Scott became involved in lengthy descriptions of moats and castles, Mrs. DeBowes would become bored and pick on us. "Jeremy Fitch, I told you you'd live to regret tearing up my camellias. You regret it now, don't you?" Jim would say he certainly did. "Thought you could kill my snow on the mountain, did you? Well, Jesse says the top's growing back out. Next time you'll know how to do it right, won't you? You'll pull it up by the roots, won't you?" Jim would say he certainly would. "Don't you mutter at me, boy. You hold up your head and say, 'Yes, ma'am.' Don't guess you feel like holding it up, though, with your father what he is." Jim's chin would come up, and he would gaze at Mrs. DeBowes with a face devoid of resentment. Through the weeks, he had cultivated an expression of polite and detached interest which he would present to her in answer to her most blood-curdling inventions. At last the day came when Mrs. DeBose said, "That'll do." One afternoon, she added, "And that's all. Good day to you." It was over. We bounded down the sidewalk on a spree of sheer relief, leaping and howling. That spring was a good one. The days grew longer and gave us more playing time. Jim's mind was occupied mostly with the vital statistics of every college football player in the nation. Every night, Atticus would read us the sports pages of the newspapers. Alabama might go to the Rose Bowl again this year, judging from its prospects, not one of whose names we could pronounce. Atticus was in the middle of Wendy Seaton's column one evening when the telephone rang. He answered it, then went to the hat rack in the hall. "I'm going down to Mrs. DeBose's for a while," he said. "I won't be long." But Atticus stayed away until long past my bedtime. When he returned, he was carrying a candy box. Atticus sat down in the living room and put the box on the floor beside his chair. "What's she want?" asked Jim. We had not seen Mrs. DeBose for over a month. She was never on the porch anymore when we passed. "She's dead, son," said Atticus. "She died a few minutes ago." "Oh," said Jim. "Well." "Well is right," said Atticus. "She's not suffering anymore. She was sick for a long time." "Son, didn't you know what her fits were?" Jim shook his head. "Mrs. DeBose was a morphine addict," said Atticus. "She took it as a painkiller for years. The doctor put her on it. She'd have spent the rest of her life on it and died without so much agony, but she was too contrary." "Sir?" said Jim. Atticus said, "Just before your escapade, she called me to make her will. Dr. Reynolds told her she had only a few months left. Her business affairs were in perfect order, but she said, there's still one thing out of order." "What was that?" Jim was perplexed. "She said she was going to leave this world beholden to nothing and nobody. Jim, when you're sick as she was, it's all right to take anything to make it easier. But it wasn't all right for her. She said she meant to break herself of it before she died, and that's what she did." Jim said, "You mean that's what her fits were?" "Yes, that's what they were. Most of the time you were reading to her, I doubt if she heard a word you said. Her whole mind and body were concentrated on that alarm clock. If you hadn't fallen into her hands, I'd have made you go read to her anyway. It may have been some distraction. There was another reason." "Did she die free?" asked Jim. "As the mountain air," said Atticus. "She was conscious to the last. Almost conscious," he smiled, "and cantankerous. She still disapproved heartily of my doings and said I'd probably spend the rest of my life bailing you out of jail. She had Jesse fix you this box." Atticus reached down and picked up the candy box. He handed it to Jim. Jim opened the box. Inside, surrounded by wads of damp cotton, was a white, waxy, perfect camellia. It was a snow on the mountain. Jim's eyes nearly popped out of his head. "Oh, hell devil! Oh, hell devil!" he screamed, flinging it down. "Why can't she leave me alone?" In a flash, Atticus was up and standing over him. Jim buried his face in Atticus's shirt front. "Shh," he said. "I think that was her way of telling you, everything's all right now, Jim. Everything's all right. You know, she was a great lady." "A lady?"
Jim raised his head. His face was scarlet. After all those things she said,